I'm usually fairly loud, so I'll try and tone it down a bit since I'm amplified. But yeah, so this is joint work with Martin Dundas that I did when I was a postdoc with him at the University of Edinburgh. And I wanted to thank Christian for the opportunity to talk and wish Eric a belated happy birthday. Certainly have run into your work all over the place. I feel like if you wander around in this world, you bump into Eric's work left and right. So it's nice to be able to be here. A quick outline. I'll just kind of give the setting, although both Shema and Steve gave some nice background, so I don't have to quite explain so many things in my 20 minutes. Some of the history of the problem, although it's lengthy, I'll try and hit a few highlights, get to our results, and then I'll try to give a small outline of the perturbation theorem. Obviously, there's limits as to what I can do in this forum. But yeah, generally speaking, as the title says, we're working with second-order non-divergence form linear operators. They're uniformly elliptic, and we're working on a bounded Lipschitz domain, which that's an interesting question brought up by this morning's earlier talks as to what actually we can say about the boundary. We assume Lipschitz because, well, that's not our specialty, so it was easier just to say Lipschitz, but it's pretty clear from the proof that we don't actually use that it's a graph-like structure. So probably NTA and something else, maybe NTA by itself would be enough, but anyway, for now we'll just assume Lipschitz. So you've got the ellipticity there, lambda is the constant for that, and in the non-divergence form case it doesn't matter that it's symmetric. That's not a crucial thing. Obviously, in the divergence form case, it matters a lot. So, assuming it's symmetric doesn't change much here. So we're working with the Dirichlet problem, and the data on the boundary is LP. So, and I'll just assume I'm just going to suppress sigma because it shows up everywhere. If you see a different measure, then that's what I'm talking about. Otherwise, I'm talking about the surface measure. Okay, so. Divergence form case is fairly nice in comparison with the non-divergence form case in that we don't even have unique solutions if you just have bounded measurable coefficients. So we have to actually define what we mean by a solution so that we have uniqueness. In Rios's papers, he gives this definition, so I'm just quoting directly from that. We just say that operator is CD if for every continuous function on the boundary we have a unique solution and it's a strong one, a unique strong solution. It's continuous up to the boundary and it's in the W2Q space. So this is fine, but how do you actually find things that are in CD? One way is if your coefficients are in VMO, then your operator is CD. But you can actually do a little bit better if you want it if you can tolerate some restricted range of the Qs of the space, of the sublevel space, then you can actually go into BMO rho, which really defining that takes a lot of work, but suffice it to say, for VMO, you know, we've got a decay in the L infinity norm of the BMO modulus. For BMO rho, you just say that there's some point at which between that there's some. I should draw it. waving your hands only gets you so far. So essentially, you know, VMO it has to vanish. This is in the standard notation eta, which is, BMO rho means that there's just some phi here, so that after, between c and zero, this, the BMO modulus drops down below some threshold, rho here. So, essentially, it's a slightly relaxed version. It doesn't have to go to zero. It just has to get small enough at some point. if I'm speaking nonsense, I apologize. These spaces are not that easy. BMO Row is a bit of a mess. So anyway, you can slightly relax it. So we have a slightly larger space of operators that automatically satisfy CD, but really figuring out exactly what this space is, characterizing it in some concrete way with a good condition, is open as far as I know, and difficult. So we will assume that this continuous condition holds on our operators. So Dahlberg's fundamental result for the Laplacian, right? Hopefully a lot of people know this. So as we heard today, we've got harmonic measure mutually absolutely continuous with surface measure on this bounded Lipschitz domain. And there's some range of p's, and this epsilon does depend on the domain on which you can uniquely solve the Dirichlet problem we're worried about. And the non-tangential maximal function of u is an LP. And that's key. Another condition is that omega is in the reverse Hölder class 2 with respect to surface measure. And here's the definition of the reverse Hölder class, if you haven't seen it before. K here is the Radon-Nikodym derivative of the measure with respect to surface measure. And Hölder's goes one way, this goes the other, so it's reverse Hölder. So weights come into play, I guess is what I'm trying to say here with this result. So I'm going to define dp as a shorthand just for saying that the LP Dirichlet problem is solvable if both CD holds and for that unique solution we have this non-tangential maximal operator bound that you need in the LP case. So the non-tangential maximal function of the unique solution that's guaranteed by the CD condition has an LP bound based on just the data. Now, this constant C here, it's innocuous, maybe, but in a conversation with Christian yesterday, I realized it's actually crucial. So I wish I'd given this a name or a number or something, but this is an important thing, and we'll call this constant CP, C sub P, later. So in order to talk about what is the perturbation theorem, we're trying to say if we have dp for one operator, how far can you be away from that operator in a certain sense and still be solvable, still have dp or maybe dq for a different q different from p. Well, measuring that, obviously the natural way to measure it is to take the difference of the coefficients. But this has been found to be the right way to do it in a certain sense. This bold A is basically the biggest difference, right, between the two operators on a ball that scales as you get close to the boundary. Obviously, it doesn't really matter, as long as we're in a nice enough space, or we're in a Lipschitz domain, it doesn't really matter what it does away from the boundary. We have comparison theorems, so that it doesn't matter. As long as they agree close to the boundary, well enough, we should be good. And the real way to capture that is if this A squared, which, remember, that's just the biggest difference between the two operators in a certain sense, if this is the density of a Carlson measure, then that's good enough. And if you want to talk about the Carlson measure having a vanishing trace, we take this condition here. You just look at the limit for small radii, and it's got to go to zero. This thing here, the smallest such C is the Carlson constant, and that's crucial. So this A squared over delta X is the essential ingredient. So what are the previous results? They all involve A squared over delta X. So you'll get tired of seeing that, possibly. So Dahlberg has this perturbation theorem in the divergence form case. And it's sharp in that you have the same P from if your original operator, the elliptic measure for that, is in the reverse Hölder class P, then the other elliptic measure is also an RHP, as long as this Carlson measure has vanishing trace. Now, in Pfefferman, Koenig, and Pfeiffer's paper on this exact subject, they reproved this theorem, and they step through it. If you step through it very carefully, you can see actually you don't need vanishing trace, you just need a very small Carlson constant. So that's an observation for later, but essentially this implies that if dp holds for L0, then dp holds for L1 as long as they're close in this Carlson measure sense. So that's our goal is this in the non-divergence form case. We have to go via Pfefferman, Koenig, and Pfeiffer's work, which we use a lot. Their proof techniques were really helpful in proving our work. So they say here, now just assume that you have any Carlson, it's just any Carlson measure. A squared over D is the density of Carlson measure. You don't have any control of the constant. What's the best you can say? The best you can say is that the measures are in A infinity. So if omega 1 is in A infinity as long as omega 0 is in A infinity, which means that some Dirichlet problem is solvable. You just don't know what your Q is. You can start knowing it is for P, but you don't know where you end up. But one of them is solvable. And they prove in this paper that if you don't restrict the Carlson constant, this is sharp, which is nice to know. And it's kind of the prettiest result, I think. You know, this kind of thing makes me happy. And then Rios put in a lot of work and brought this over to the non-divergence form case. So it's a bit messier. Like we said before, there's this non-uniqueness business with the continuous Dirichlet condition you've got to put on it. So the main extra hypotheses you need is that the coefficients are in this BMO row space. It's the most general space that either of us could figure out that this works in. So not only do you have dp, but you also have the coefficients are somehow controlled. Then, again, if a squared over d over delta is a density of a Carlson measure, then you get the a infinity type result, the large constant result. And wrapping back around, sort of we had specific tight bounds with Dahlberg, went up to Pfefferman, Koenig, Pfeiffer, over to Rios, and then back down. So we use both Pfefferman, Koenig, Pfeiffer's machinery and Rios's machinery and pull it together. And we get that if you have two operators, L0 and L1, if the Carlson constant is sufficiently small, and we have, again, we have to assume this coefficient in BMO rho, then there is some upper bound for the allowable Carlson constants, and you get back to the same P. So the CP I mentioned earlier, the coefficient in the non-tangential maximum function, is actually crucial because otherwise you could just chain together two very far apart operators, and as long as you interpolate it and have very, very small steps, this Carlson measure is going to be small, but you can't get there because of this upper bound depends on, it gets tighter and tighter and tighter the worse your non-tangential maximum function estimate is. So it blows up if you are trying to connect two operators that don't both have dp holding for them. Okay, so this is the perturbation theorem. Got a few more minutes. We use it to prove a more relaxed solvability theorem. Koenig and Pfeiffer, and then Dendisch and Peter Michael and Pfeiffer, both sort of have built on this theory some solvability results. The last one, the DPP paper here, has a gradient condition on the coefficients in the non-tangential case. In the non-divergence form case. And this, our new perturbation theorem allows us to relax that. So we no longer have to assume a gradient condition on the coefficients. We now just have this averaging condition. So essentially, you know, it has a sort of BMO-ish flavor to it. But if this is the density of a Carlson measure, then we have solvability. And I don't have time to go into the proof of this as well, but it depends on the perturbation result in a strong way. Essentially, we start with something they have here with their gradient condition and prove that you can take something with this condition, smooth it out a little bit, and its distance from itself to the smoothed-out version of itself satisfies our perturbation theorem, and then the smoothed-out one satisfies their solvability theorem. So you get solvability for this new condition. So, again, I wish I had time to go into that proof, but I figured I'd focus on the perturbation theorem because it's a little bit nicer and easier to state. Okay, so we're assuming that the Carlson constant of A squared over delta is smaller than some bound M. If we tighten M enough, we can make sure that our second operator is in CD. So you crank down it. Basically, you're cranking down the behavior of A1 in the L infinity BMO sense. And we can also guarantee that the ellipticity constant is bounded away from zero. So we have a good operator. So solution, speaking of the solution, makes sense. That's always important. And what we look at is the difference between the two. And that's the trick. What we're trying to prove is that the non-tangential maximal operator of U1 satisfies this bound. And what we'll in fact show is that N of F satisfies that bound. And then F is just a perturbation of U0. So that's all right. And there's a whole mess of machinery. I mean, it took a long time for me to even read Rios' papers. Because these modified non-tangential maximal operators require a lot of theory of normalized adjoint solutions, and there's a whole lot of stuff I'm not going to go into, but suffice it to say, it's a non-tangential maximal operator type of thing. Our first key lemma was that you can bound this modified non-tangential maximal operator by a Hardy-Littlewood maximal function kind of thing. This is legitimately the Hardy-Littlewood maximal function associated to the harmonic measure for the first operator. This A is not the secondary function you know and love if you've worked in this stuff. It's modified. Everything in here is modified. So, okay, that's just a bound we're going to use right here, what you'll see right away. So we have the thing we're trying to prove is small. We replace it by something larger. The bound we have is on this thing, so we get the Hardy-Littlewood maximal function. And lo and behold, everything we have set up so far means that sigma is an AP of d omega naught, which is what you need to peel off the maximal operator, right? So that's what we do. And we get back to the second area function. So you work a little bit more, and I'm trying to accelerate a bit, sorry. And you can bound this thing by the square functions or area functions, depending on what your favorite nomenclature is. And as you might imagine, this thing isn't too bad, because we know that the problem is solvable for L0. And that's what we have to bound. Well, the second half of the paper is essentially trying to prove this corollary via a good lambda inequality that is a real mess. If you want to see it, I'll show it to you later. But we do. And so the square function of F, you know, is sufficiently bounded. We already know that's nice. We have it bound. And that's, again, not a problem to deal with. So you recombine everything, and you have this on the left and this on the right. You make that small enough and pull it over, and we've got what we need. So in 6 minutes, that was the proof of the theorem. Yeah, I guess that's a good place to stop because I'm out of time. So thank you.